Did you ever do this when you were a kid, when you go to the medicine cabinet and you have like the mirror in the bathroom and then you have like the medicine cabinet on the wall and you just sort of like open it up and all of a sudden there's like multiple versions of yourself and you're like, whoa. That's what that scene felt like to me. Like, I couldn't really take it seriously because all I can think about is me doing the thing with the medicine cabinet and like seeing all these parallel versions of myself. I still do that today just for fun.
Welcome to Death Watch, the Star Wars podcast from a galaxy not so far, far away. I'm Mike Bennett.
And I'm Chris Skull.
And today we're joined by a friend of the podcast, Brooke Derenberger, to talk about the best movie in the entire Star Wars franchise, nay, in all of cinema, The Last Jedi.
So we've discussed how this movie has been a pretty divisive, I guess, in the Star Wars fandom. And Mike and I have not made, you know, secret how we've felt about the movie, but we do want to discuss how the fandom had actually gotten a little polarized when it comes to this like specific movie. So we've invited our friend Brooke, who is a fan of The Last Jedi, to talk about the more positive aspects of the movie and maybe share some things, some insights, you know, to us as to why it actually is a better movie than we may have realized.
Yeah, so
So we're
Brooke, why
gonna
don't you tell us a little bit about how you first got into Star Wars and introduce yourself to our audience?
Sure. Well, my name is Brooke. I am a content creator, if you will, on TikTok. It's just at B underscore Dazzler. So where I post most of my stuff, mostly Star Wars, but since all of the Marvel stuff has been coming out, I've been getting into that too. How I got into Star Wars is, I will preface this by saying The Last Jedi was the first Star Wars movie I watched in theaters. So maybe that's why I have got a little bit of a bias or an
Interesting.
attachment to it. I remember watching the originals growing up, kind of just like when they were on TV, it was something good to have on. I think I watched, I remember I had like a Jar Jar Binks like toy. So I think at some point I like vaguely remember watching The Phantom Menace. It came out when I was like
Oof.
4 or 5, so still pretty young. It wasn't until I started dating my current partner, because he was a big Star Wars fan. We found his Revenge of the Sith movie ticket a couple months ago, and we were going through some of his
Nice.
old stuff. So he reintroduced it to me, I guess. And when he went to see The Force Awakens. And I was still not like sold. I was like, like I like Star Wars, but I don't know. And then once I watched it, and it was like right before The Last Jedi was coming out, I was like, I definitely want to see the next one in theaters. I feel like that will sway me into liking it more, which was definitely true. I definitely fell in love with it afterwards. So I feel like I've got kind of a unique
You
experience with
do,
Star
and
Wars.
that's something. That's the reason why I really wanted to do this episode. Also, was kind of based on a conversation I had with my brother-in-law and my niece, and I'm like, I'm in the middle of these two completely polarized. They're both Star Wars fans, but they represent two completely different generations. Where you have like the old school, grew up with the trilogy, prequels were eh, sequels were whatever, versus her, who is growing up with only the sequels, who was introduced at a very young age because of her dad to like the old, you know, DVDs of the Star Wars, but like she's actually getting to experience Star Wars herself via the sequels, and she's fallen in love with it. So I find it very interesting how, like, from your experience, like you said, your bias, this movie, this one in particular, that's what sort of formed the foundation of your love of Star Wars. And I think that's really awesome. Because it still has these elements of what makes Star Wars in general, you know, across all nine movies, what makes it really great, but also has its own unique take to it as well. So that's kind of what we want to talk about.
So, Chris, where does this movie fit into the timelines of the movies?
So we know that this takes place between The Force Awakens and The Rise of Skywalker. So this is going to take place at least 40 so years after the events of Return of the Jedi. Old man Luke, old man Han, old woman, sorry, old Leia, they have a lot of experience having to, you know, deal with the rise and fall of the Empire. Now a new threat has emerged by way of the First Order.
Wait, say and that again. Did you say 40 years after the return of the Jedi? No.
Was it 40 years?
Ben was born like...
Oh, yeah, that's true.
That day.
How old would Kylo Ren be? He'd be at least early 20s.
I want to say Ben was born like 5 ABY. And he was like maybe... Close to 30.
Okay, so
maybe I'm off. So you're not, you weren't too far off.
So 25.
35.
So 15.
35, yeah. 40 years after the Return of the Jedi.
Yeah, okay. So, but either way, a lot has passed. There's a big chunk of time that we still don't know what happens between The Last Jedi and Force Awakens, which hopefully Mandalorian.
Luckily, we have The Mandalorian.
Yeah, so hopefully that'll fill in a lot of gaps. So why don't we dive into the episode? We'll talk about what is in from your experience, what is the Last Jedi? Who's involved? Who are the main components of it? And what are the overall themes that you observed are important? We know we have Kylo Ren, son of Leia and Han, and now deceased at this point, Han Solo.
R.I.P.
man. That hurt.
Brutal.
I'm not gonna lie, that scene hurt. And I think it was, you know, I mean, it was intentional that it hurt, but it hurt. What is Kylo Ren's state at this moment in The Last Jedi? Like, as soon as the movie opens, what is his mental state, in your opinion?
I think this movie is, I mean, it's unique to say the least, but it's also unique in the fact that it happens right after The Force Awakens, where I think every other Star Wars movie, there's a significant time jump in between. So like in the originals, all of the character development or like Luke's kind of training to become a Jedi kind of happens all off screen. So I feel like this is different in the fact that it happens right after the events of The Force Awakens. So as far as Kylo's character goes, we saw him struggling with the pull to the light in The Force Awakens. In that happening, that was a big kind of like reason why he wanted to try to kill his own father, because he thought that that would fully engulf him into the dark side. And one of his, you know, opening scenes with Snoke is like, yeah, well, that split your soul to the bone. So he's even more conflicted than he was in the previous movie.
Yeah.
And so that's like a
Snoke
big
is a huge jerk
kind
to
of
him.
Starting
he's
point.
Like,
he's really rubbing it in a really intense emotional moment. And he's like, look at you being a little child about this.
Mm-hmm.
He's
check off that silly little mask of yours.
Yeah, he's really laying it on.
That's a theme. That's also something I want to talk about later on is that relationship between Snoke and Kylo. Now, that's not something that did confuse me. Was a time period that passes between The Force Awakens and The Last Jedi. Like I don't know if it's actually been pinpointed exactly how much time. It's definitely, yeah, makes us think literally like they just blew up Starkiller Base. They go back to their base. They're discovered and
the
they got to run.
The scene of Force Awakens is Rey handing the lightsaber to Luke. And I know the first scene is back on the Rebel base, but when we cut back to Octo, it's that same exact moment. Her hand is still extended. So assuming that those are happening parallel to each other, we are literally the same second after The Force Awakens picking it right back up.
Yeah, that's kind of what, yeah, I kind of figured it had to have been at best, even if they're not exactly parallel, at best a few days, few weeks, still definitely not a few years compared to like the time period that we think is happening between Empire, for instance, Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi. What other notable characters should we be paying attention to in The Last Jedi, Brooke?
So what I like a lot about The Last Jedi is that a lot of the main characters are all given kind of a full story arc, or they learn a lesson throughout the movie. So I would say Kylo Ren is definitely a big one. Rey, of course,
who?
Is a big one. Luke.
Yeah. Rey who?
Rey who? Mm-hmm. Luke is a good one, really good one to pay attention to. But even Poe and Finn have their own little story arcs. As much as I wanted more out of Finn's character, I'm sure a lot of us have for the sequels. With what we were given, he was given kind of a full arc throughout that movie. So I would say that those were kind of the main people to be looking
at. And Rose as well, because I think you were the one who had revealed this to me, was that Rose, when we first see her, she's crying. She lost it's not that she lost her sister, which is already a big deal. That was the last of her family. And I probably like the last of her whole planet. I think the First Order had pulled an Alderaan on her homeworld. And that's why she and her sister joined up with the Resistance. So with the opening scene that we, with the carpet bombing on the dreadnought, that was literally the last of her whole everything. So there was a lot of hate on her character. Especially her treatment, like in the last or one of the last scenes in the movie. But when I started rewatching it, I kind of had a better appreciation for not just, you know, what she's going through emotionally, but for her level of intelligence. And then the fact that despite all that, she still wants to focus her energies on something and to help Finn.
And even, you know, it's somewhat of a less heroic role at the beginning. Like she's volunteering for the Resistance, but she's kind of like a janitor mechanic on the ship. Like, you know, she's in the hold of the ship near the escape pods. She has this like rise from intense loss, like you said, her family and probably her entire people, to a lowly rank on the Resistance, to by the end of the next film too, she has this huge arc of becoming a major influencer. And
which is a parallel to Finn himself also, because it was revealed in the last movie that he just mopped the base. He was just, you know, janitorial. But he, even in her own words, he was a hero of the Resistance. He never saw himself that way. He's like, no. But it's interesting that now that I saw it that second time around, I get to appreciate that both of them actually had parallel, even though they were from different sides, they still had very parallel origins and were able to grow into positive characters in the Resistance at the same time.
Yeah,
absolutely.
What I like about her character too is the way she relates to other people in broken situations, like the kids who are in the stable, or even those the horses. I forget what their species is called, but she has like a deep empathy for people who are you know, hurting and in peril. And I think that also like makes her a valuable member of the Resistance, because I think she'll be important in recruiting people. But I think also just knowing that she cares deeply for those around her is great.
Not enough to free the orphans though. The horses are okay. The space horses are fine. Let's let them go. But the orphans, they stay in the stable.
I never thought about that actually.
Ouch, that hurts.
What about
she liked them enough to show off her ring.
Look at this cool Cracker Jack ring that I got.
It is a cool ring though. Can you get, I haven't seen that. I assumed that would be a bigger merchandising thing.
I think you can buy them somewhere. I remember kind of seeing them. I scroll through Star Wars merchandise all the time.
That's cool. What about the villains? Who are the protagonists? Because we know that Snoke plays an overall about halfway through the movie. He is the puppet master. At least we're made to think that he's the puppet master. But then the second half of the movie, the villain changes. And it's sort of maybe Kylo Ren again.
It's Hux.
It's Hux is still kind of, you know, whatever. He's still kind of like ragdolling around. And, you know, you want him to be more of a presence as a villain, but even he's also being puppeted by the puppet master, so to speak. And that's so, in terms of themes, for instance, what are the most important themes in the movie do you think that we should be paying attention to?
Yeah, well, I would say as far as who the villains are, obviously we want to see Snoke as like the big bad. And even listening to interviews with Adam Driver talking about his character, he even said that he never viewed Kylo Ren as the villain. He tried to play him like almost like a protagonist. Like he, what he thought he was doing
was right.
Was right.
He's pulling a Thanos, essentially. If you think about it.
Yeah. And I feel more like him and Rey are kind of two halves of the protagonist of this movie. You can argue that maybe Poe is a protagonist, Finn is a protagonist. But they're a lot more of a side character, if anything, in this movie. So a big theme is facing your own demons, I would say, is a big villain of all of the characters. This movie's very, a lot of it's very like psychological, or they have a lot of emotional struggle in this movie, the characters do, more so than, you know, fighting a big bad. Even though we do have some villainous stuff from Snoke, obviously. But I would argue it's more intrinsic than a lot of the other Star Wars movies. I would say that's why I like this movie. And people look at me like I have three heads when I say that this movie is a lot like Empire Strikes Back.
I don't disagree with you.
It totally is.
There's literally a snow planet with AT-AT walkers at the very end of the movie. This is not like there are very obvious parallels.
Rey goes to the lavish, Cloud City. To face Darth Vader. I mean, Snoke. It really is. It mirrors it in a lot of ways.
Cave. That's why there's so many parallels. A lot of the themes surrounding, you know, what the Force is and what that means to the universe, is a big connection there too. That's why I always say I love the middle children of the trilogies.
Yeah.
I was thinking about this last night, and it's kind of like you have one side of the movie where there are like two characters or one character like stuck somewhere while the other characters are going on like essentially a very pointless adventure from planet to planet.
Yeah, I'm not gonna sugarcoat it. I still don't really understand the other arc. Like I understand the conflict between Kylo and Rey, but the whole tangent is not, I feel like the story could have been a little tightened, a little polished on that end, but it is good to see that there were elements of those different characters growing in different ways, like Finn, Poe, and Rose. Go ahead, man.
I would say if we could for a moment, I'd like to talk about Luke Skywalker and his role and impact in the movie. I think his perception is one of the reasons why this movie gets so much, you know, frustration is, you know, the last that we see him in The Last Jedi, or sorry, The Return of the Jedi, he is this, you know, he's reached his Jedi Knight rank. He's extremely talented in the Force and he's defeated the Empire. And we also had books in the, you know, the 3 decades since that movie came out that say how great he is and how powerful he is. And then we are confronted with a broken version of that Luke. Not to say that it's really, this movie comes after whatever those books were describing, because he does have that experience that we seem to understand, but he experiences a huge, you know, tragedy in his life, a failure of his own personality. And then we see him as this sort of broken, defeated person. And I think we were, especially when the whole movie before this was kind of talking about, where is Luke? We need to get Luke. And even the sarcastic line that he says, what did you think I was going to do? Stand in front of the whole First Order with a laser sword and defeat them? Like, we were like, yeah, that's what we thought you were going to do. We thought you were just going to defeat everybody. And then we get that first moment where he grabs Anakin's lightsaber and he just chucks it. And we're like, how, like, it was like sacrilege to throw away what felt like six movies worth of history and feeling. And so I think that was really an intense like introduction to Luke's character at this point.
But also what's made it more interesting is to turn it on its head, which what our expectation was. And that version of Luke that we were used to, that strong, powerful OP Luke, like end of the Mandalorian Luke, you know, we wanted it to see that, but that's not human.
Well, and you know, what it is like Brooke, you just said, this is a parallel between Empire Strikes Back. The Yoda that we see in The Empire Strikes Back is this is broken, defeated Jedi who had it all, was literally the most powerful Jedi, and he now lives by himself as a crazy old hermit in a swamp. And that's exactly where Luke is at this point, where he was at the pinnacle. He's now at the bottom of his life, and that's where we get to see him. So I think the fact that we got Yoda in reverse, we saw him at his bottom when we first met him, and then we see him in the prequels as this like talented guy. We were, I think, hoping Luke just kind of went up and to the right, our entire perception of him. So again, perfect parallel between that movie, between The Empire Strikes Back, but it wasn't the parallel that we wanted. And I, as we keep talking about this, I know that the interview with George Lucas when he made the prequels, and he was talking about how the trilogies, like, they rhyme and sort of, and which was, I think people make fun of that line, but I also think it's kind of a brilliant like description of movies rhyming, because they're not copied, because copies are not, those are the same thing. A rhyme is not the same thing. It's like similar, but not. So I think it is really cool to see this trilogy rhyming. Honestly, the Force Awakens was basically a copy. It almost felt like a copy
of A New Hope.
This feels like a more distant, it's like the reverberation of a rhyme. It's like a couple of echoes beyond it, but still follows the same kind of trends.
There were also a couple of other themes that I wanted to discuss overall. Like there's the concept of failure. There's certain elements of symbolism in the movie that I think you've brought out to me before, and I want to talk about. And then also relationships, how different types of relationships are forming, and how they can form, and how they can break, and the consequences of such. So one of the first thing I wanted to talk about was this pattern I kept noticing of failure, like Kylo failing Snoke in the very beginning, Poe failing Leia, Luke failing Ben failing Rey. Rey thinks that she's failing Luke. Holdo failing the Resistance, in a sense. She sacrificing herself as a consequence of that. Finn almost failing
Rose at the end of it. So this pattern keeps repeating of the emphasis of loss. Like, failure happens, we learn from it, and we grow and move on. Not everybody does that, but because failure can stay with them for a very, very long time, and they become bitter for it. And that's the parallel that I saw between Luke and Kylo versus someone like Rey. She takes that failure and she's like, nah, I'm not going to let this keep me down. I'm going to keep going until I can, you know, become better from it. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. A failure is definitely a huge theme that we see. And I like it a lot because it humanizes these characters that, you know, live in this fantasy world that we like desperately want to be a part of. But at the end of the day, there's still stories about people and relationships and life.
So I really liked that aspect of it. Which is why I do really like Luke's character and how it's portrayed. I do understand why people or how people would be disappointed, you know, walking into this movie being like, all right, we're going to figure out what Luke's been up to, and knowing where he was in Return of the Jedi, how jarring it would be to see him that way. And so if you're disappointed in that, if you don't like it, there's nothing wrong with that. I think that's okay. for me, I didn't have the same connection to Luke's character like I do with other characters in Star Wars. And this movie gave me a better understanding of him, and I could connect to his character a lot more. And I've heard that from other people that do enjoy it too. They want to see their heroes broken, because that's just what is more, I don't know, realistic, I guess. So I feel like the movie itself puts emphasis on this, because as an audience, we're projecting what we want to see Luke as. But in the same vein, the galaxy also views Luke as this, you know, legend who blew up the Death Star and saved the galaxy from the Empire. And even Luke acknowledges, like, I'm not the Luke that you think I am. Because as an audience, we know everything that Luke had to go through. But the galaxy doesn't. They just see him as this beacon of hope. And if you grew up watching the originals and also viewing Luke like that, it's definitely going to be super jarring to see this broken man on an island. And I can even understand why you think that it wouldn't be something that he does. And he addresses that in the movie. He's like, I know this is pathetic, but this is what I am now.
I came to this island to die.
Deal with it. Right. So the movie's not, as much as we want to say that it's, you know, the word, like the term subverting expectations is always thrown around with this movie. It is self-aware that it's of what it's doing. And I really like Rian Johnson as a filmmaker. Outside of Star Wars, I really like the other things that he's written and directed. And so I had faith in him, or I have faith in him, that he knew what he was doing. It wasn't that he didn't understand Star Wars or didn't understand the characters. I think he really tried to put himself in the shoes of the situation and didn't write what he wanted to see. He wrote what was real.
He was trying to put in elements that were found in Legends lore, wasn't he? Like the famed Force time Skyping space, whatever, with Luke. That was not something that had been discussed in the new canon, which was at that time still fairly new. But that was something that was pulled in the 30 years of Legends after the Last Jedi. So he was trying to put those elements, those known written elements, together. At the end of the day, if people don't like something enough, they're gonna nitpick and find something wrong, no matter what. So you might as well just, you know, move forward with what you got and do the best that you can. And that aspect I understand. With certain relationships, there's the other theme that I found was control. There's another word control definitely seems to be a theme, especially when it comes to Snoke versus Kylo. And then the first half of that movie is that relationship, and then the second half of that movie is Kylo and Rey, Kylo trying to control Rey, and then the consequences of trying to play on that control. Like, what did you notice about that?
So in The Force Awakens, I think it was compared to the original trilogy, we right off the bat find out that, oh, Kylo Ren isn't the big bad. There is a Palpatine-like figure behind all of this. Instead of finding out in the second movie, we find out in the first. We already kind of get a little bit of information as far as how their relationship is. Snoke is very condescending. He acts like he doesn't have a lot of faith in Kylo Ren. He says, you know, you're being pulled to the light. Like, what are you going to do about it? And I think that first scene, that first exchange between them in The Last Jedi gives us so much about what their relationship is like. When Kylo Ren says, like, I've given everything to you. And Snoke is like, well, it's not enough. That, like, broke me. Snoke is like the classic example of someone who is trigger warning abusive.
Mm-hmm. That's what I wanted to discuss. And I saw that relationship as well. And it bothered me, but it's supposed to bother you. And kind of like what you were just talking about, how we as an audience looked at Luke as a sort of the perfect protagonist, but now we see him as broken. We are Kylo. Kylo saw that in his uncle Luke. He saw him as a family, but also a father figure and a mentor and trying to teach him the ways of the Force. And then with this one act, he sees him as something completely different, and that broke him. And then at the time, Snoke, Palpatine, whatever, they're feeding in the little seeds of doubt in his mind this whole time since he was very young. And that is the moment that they were waiting for. And that's the moment where Ben realizes that this was not the path for him. There's a different path. So he sees Snoke as a father figure instead. But unfortunately, Snoke, being the controlling entity that he is not a father figure. He just wants to use him. And Kylo, unfortunately, doesn't realize that.
Right. He's very manipulative. Mm-hmm. And the Rise of Kylo Ren comic, I really like that run of that comic was really great and gave us a lot more information into his relationship with Snoke growing up.
If some of our audience members haven't seen the comic, would you mind going a little bit into some of the things that we've seen in that arc?
Yeah, sure. So the Rise of Kylo Ren comic essentially starts off with what happened between Luke and Ben at the temple. So we start off, we see, you know, the aftermath of their exchange. The temple blows up. What is interesting is that it's not really explained how the temple blows up. I know in The Last Jedi, it's like, well, Kylo Ren killed everybody and then left with some students. But we find out that it's actually happened a little bit differently, which is, I think, adds to The Last Jedi, because we find out that Luke is this unreliable narrator. So he's only, you know, retelling what he thinks happened. Mm-hmm. But we see that the temple blows up. He's like, Kylo even says, or Ben even says, like, this isn't what I wanted. And Snoke in his mind is like, well, this is what you are now, so you should just own it. And there's actually some students who weren't there who come back to this mess and decide to go try to find Ben, try to fix things. We see Ben go to Snoke, and this is where we kind of see their relationship, how it is sort of like a father figure. I think Snoke has manipulated Ben into thinking everyone in his family, everyone in his life is out to get him, or that they think he's, you know, he's not living up to his name. Essentially until Snoke is like, well, I'm all you have left. And there's this one panel of the comic where Ben goes to Snoke and he's like, I'm glad you came to me. And they have this weird hug. It's super awkward.
Well,
it's like, hey, I'm trying to be
comforting. It's weird because Snoke is just like this writhing, you know, pre-cocoon, like caterpillar type thing. He's like, kind of walking around because he's not human. He's something. He's what they call him, a Strandcast.
Yeah.
Which I think was referred to, or that's what we saw in the Bacta tanks in that one scene in The Mandalorian. They were growing something.
I think so.
And it's like it's sort of alluded, and some people have heard Snoke's theme playing when they're zooming in on those Bacta tanks in the Mandalorian. So it's possible that's like the very early versions. And then in The Last Jedi, in The Rise of Skywalker, one of the opening scenes is you see like the leftover, you know, Snoke's in the Bacta tank. So Snoke is not a real person, but enough to be a puppet for the Emperor and to puppet Kylo. And then this idea of control and manipulation, and, you know, it is important to talk about these themes And I think what aggravated some people, some of the fan base, is because that wasn't really a truly Star Wars experience. But Star Wars tells stories. It tells real stories of hope and despair. But this is the first time that it talked about this relationship of control and manipulation and how it affects a person really deeply. And to be blunt, how it can also affect a man, which is not something that a lot of people in society talk about. How even it's usually the man manipulating the woman, which we see in that relationship with Kylo and Rey. But very rarely do we talk about a man being manipulated, especially by another man. So these relationships of how it's important that a person recognizes these things so that they see a story being told in parallel to something that someone else might experience in hopes that someone looks at this and goes, hey, that seems familiar. That's not right. You know, that's not how a relationship should be. And then we Kylo has that moment when they're back in the throne room. Rey's on, you know, he's in front of Snoke. And then that's the moment that Kylo realizes, nah, I don't need this guy anymore. I can go on my own. And then he decides to, he basically decides to cut Snoke in half. So,
yes, I think he didn't realize exactly the hold that Snoke had over him until he saw it happening to someone else. Which, I mean, parallels kind of in what happened in Return of the Jedi with Vader and Luke. Once Palpatine was like, hey, Luke, you could be mm-hmm. my new apprentice, or you can join us on the dark side. That's when Vader realizes Palpatine is not your friend, is not here to help you like you thought mm-hmm. he was. So I like that parallel a lot too. I think getting rid of Snoke, or Kylo breaking free of the hold that Snoke had over him, was very integral to his character development. And I know a lot of people have issue with, well, we don't know anything about Snoke. We didn't know mm-hmm. anything about him. I wanted to know more about his character. And I kind of view it the same way. Like, in the originals, we knew nothing about the mm-hmm. Emperor. And obviously, we've gotten so much more Star Wars media since then. We've gotten the prequels, so we do kind of have a little bit of a backstory of where Palpatine came from. But just comparing those two trilogies, they're essentially the same plot device. Yeah,
I agree. And that's, now that you mentioned it, I did, that is a relationship that was expounded on in the prequels and in the Clone Wars and even in Rebels, how Emperor Palpatine is the controller. He is the manipulator, the master manipulator. It was Palpatine all along, you know, and how he was trying to manipulate Anakin from the very beginning, even to a degree he tried with Ezra Bridger in that one scene. And of course, he can't do it physically himself, so he goes and he sends his genetically altered lackey to do it for him. So yeah, I kind of agree. There's no need to expound on Snoke when Snoke was always a puppet, and Snoke represented what the Emperor already did in the first six movies. So it didn't really matter to continue that. Was it Hannah? She was on our last episode, and she mentioned he was just a device. He was just a vehicle to be able to transport Kylo in his growth as a character. And in that regard, I agree with. So very much like Snoke, why don't we cut this episode in half and we'll take an ad break. We'll be right back.
Has your Rebel cell recently relocated and your home base is in need of a renovation?
Was your Jedi Temple burned down by an angsty Skywalker and now you're looking to rebuild?
Or maybe you're just trying to add a few smuggling compartments to hide in during an Imperial search? Well, Delta Designers is here to help.
Delta is a nationwide network of architects and designers led by Chris and myself.
If you're ready to start that home renovation you've been putting off, click on the link in the show notes or shoot us an email to mike@deltadesigners.com.
Mention Death Watch for $100 off a feasibility study and make a plan today.
This is the way.
This episode of Death Watch is also brought to you by Skull Square Design Company. We're also huge fans of The Mandalorian, as well as Star Wars in general, and we wanted to share that love by making gifts for our fellow fans of Mando and the Child. Whether you wanted some flair while enjoying your favorite beverage in Oga's Cantina, or wanted to covertly show your support to the Resistance while exploring Batuu, we've got gifts for everybody. And not just Star Wars fans, but Marvel and Disney fans too. Check us out at skullsquared.com or follow us on social media at skullsquared. That's skull with a C, as in,
see y'all real soon.
And we're back. So we've been talking about The Last Jedi, and we can't ignore, and we've been talking about relationships. We cannot ignore the relationship, if you will, between Kylo and Rey. I was listening to the Sithsters podcast, and I like the way that they describe them is basically they're just two idiots in love. they have, each of them are unique, and each of them do have their own parallels in a certain way, where they're both naive with certain things, but they do have this inherent ability to trust their gut about each other, to trust their instincts about each other. And just like a person in love or feeling very amorous to another person, it makes them feel dumb and makes them do dumb things. Like, we do dumb things when we're in love. Did you feel that was the case with Kylo and Rey?
A little bit, yeah. I do like that two idiots in love is funny to me. I would say that it was maybe a little bit more on Kylo's end, because essentially the entire trilogy, he's just following her around.
He's focused. He's the type of person that's like hyper focused on something. He's always reaching out for something he can't have.
Yeah, and Rey's kind of more like the hothead. Every time he shows up, she's like, lightsaber out, let's go. And he's like, whoa, I just wanted to have a conversation,
that's actually a pretty interesting role reversal. I like that, actually. Or rather, I like that observation.
Yeah, I think their shared trauma, man, is like a very... It brings people together, I guess, if you want to call it that, which is it's kind of interesting, because Kylo and Rey grew up on opposite ends of the spectrum as far as their childhood. Rey grew up with nothing. Her parents left her. She had to fend for herself. She worked for this terrible guy. Whereas Kylo grew up with essentially everything. Yet they still have this common ground of not feeling good enough, not knowing who they really are as people, trying to be something they're not, or not willing to, you know, take the mantle. Rey's journey throughout the trilogy is a lot about her own self-worth and her own self-doubt, and realizing that this time... She has to be the hero. She can't give it away. She can't bring it, like, in The Force Awakens, she was trying to put it on Han and Finn. The Last Jedi, she spends basically the entire movie trying to get Luke to come back. And then she even says, well, if you're not coming back, then Ben is our only hope, because I truly believe that he will turn.
Yeah.
Obviously, that didn't work out the way she wanted it to.
That's something.
And I don't even think it was until, like, midway through Rise of Skywalker that she realizes, like, oh, it's me this time. I have to do this.
Yeah, that's something that I realized about her character, is that because she had nothing and because she had no one, naturally her instinct is to try to reach out. And like, oh, hey, person I just met in the desert and now stormtroopers are shooting at us, you are my new best friend. And, you know, she has a sense of loyalty. It's a fierce loyalty. She has a longing for connection, for people, and in essence, she knows that Kylo is at first she sees him as a bad guy, but she sort of feels, I guess this is part of the dyad, is she feels that he's a good guy, just does bad things. And that's what drew him together, and how she let her, and this isn't, I don't know if you agree with me on this one, but She let down her survival instinct, which is a very dark side kind of quality. Let's ignore the fact that we know that she has Palpatine genes. She let down her survival instinct, which I feel is a very dark side quality, and he started building up his compassion, which is a very light side quality. So each of them were either building up or tearing down what we perceive as the opposite on the external of, you know, of the character. Each of them are building up or tearing down something that is opposite in their character, and that's how they were able to meet each other halfway. And now that I'm thinking about it, in terms of symbolism, the charm that Rose had and her sister, what was her sister's name? I think it was Paige. Okay, yes, so Paige. Rose and Paige each had like matching interlocking medallion, which is of course a direct metaphor to the idea of yin and yang. I'm realizing now that that was a foreshadow to the dyad that Kylo and Rey would have later on in the movie.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they taught each other a lot throughout that movie. I think they both, Rey especially, was kind of the first person that viewed Kylo as a human being. She didn't view him as a villain after a while. She didn't view him as, oh, you're the son of Han Solo and Leia, like you're the nephew of Luke Skywalker, which is something that he was told his entire life that he felt like he had to live up to, but just couldn't. So she kind of just viewed him as Ben, the person. And I think to a point, she felt the same way about Kylo kind of seeing her and them having a mutual understanding of how they were feeling, which I think is, you know, a dyad aside, they had a lot to connect them. Other than, you know, just the force connection that
right.
they had.
There were certain elements that they saw in each other that parallel their experiences. What did bother me though was, and this going back to the conversation that we had about manipulation, is that he kept calling her like nothing. You're from nothing. And I think that was
he was just flirting.
That's a I mean, if you grew up the way that he did and you don't know how to talk to girls, this is exactly how I imagine Kylo Ren will be talking to girls.
Yeah, it's on brand for his character. Just like in Attack of the Clones, Anakin is super awkward because he's never talked to a woman before. I think it does say a lot about Kylo Ren as a person though, because he was treated this way by Snoke. He doesn't know, and he had struggles with his parents. It didn't seem like, from what I've done, that they really fought, but
they weren't close either.
They weren't close. Kylo was showing these dark side tendencies that they didn't know how to handle, and so they were like, well, if Luke trains him and like gets him to learn to control his emotions, get him to control his power, it'll help. But it was twisted to get Kylo to believe that they were just throwing him away and giving him to someone else because they didn't want to deal with him.
Yeah.
So he doesn't know what a healthy relationship is. And that's not an excuse for how he talked to Rey. But I think in that scene, in that moment, he was trying to say, I understand you. Like, you're nothing, but it's fine. The way that he said it was not the best. But it's still on kind of brand with his character and how his understanding of relationships and his understanding with the world.
So that scene when they're in the hut, when they're both on Octo and they're both like reaching out and they just barely like the literal, they're longing for like a literal physical connection because they're distance apart, but they were longing for that obvious emotional connection. Like, let's help each other out. There's literal icons that I noticed. The tree, for instance, on Octo, when Rey's walking up to the old ancient tree with the Jedi text, that I read was supposed to be an abstract interpretation of the Rebel and the Resistance insignia. Kind of looks like the Warbird, or like the Phoenix, sort of like the Phoenix crest that we've seen in mm-hmm. Rebels.
Okay.
And I'm going to talk about this scene in a second because I'm still very confused about it. But the scene where she goes in, I'm going to call it the dark side hole. I don't know what else to call it, when she goes in the cave and there's these roots that grow up from the hole, from the center, and they sort of spread out. It's meant to also look like the First Order logo. I think that's a callback to like how it radiates out. So I'm like, it's a very uh-huh. specific thing to show on screen. Like, it has to represent something. Mm-hmm. And it does kind of look like the First Order logo. So in that scene, she goes down the rabbit hole and she has this mirror sequence. I'm completely confused as to what that was supposed to mean. I have no idea. Could you shed some light on that?
Yeah, sure. I can try at least. So like we said earlier, Star Wars movies seem to kind of rhyme in a sense. So to me, that was very reminiscent of Luke and his journey into the cave on Dagobah. They had kind of different understandings of what was happening and what they would find in there. I think Luke thought he knew. He was kind of like, I know all of this stuff already. I don't need to learn anything. And that's why he brought his weapon in, because he was like, well, if there's going to be danger in there, I want to protect myself or whatever it is. When Yoda's like, you need don't, it. That's yeah. not the point. Yeah, you don't need it. So for Rey, I think she, while Luke thought he had all the answers, Rey was looking for answers, the answers that she's wanted her entire life. And that first lesson that she has with Luke, she sees that cave and she wants to go. She's like, it's calling to me. And Luke's like, no, you have to resist that. So she, while she doesn't ever fall to the dark side, she still sees the temptation in it. So her, I think, journey into that is her searching for the answers of, who am I? Who are my parents? Where did I come from? Why am I here? She's still very afraid of this power that she's discovered that she has, which is why she wants Luke to train her. She doesn't want Luke to train her so she can go save the galaxy. She's just like, I just need to figure out myself. So what I took away from that whole thing with the mirror is, I think, a lot of it was kind of symbolic of her waiting her entire life, because it's almost like she's waiting in a line. She's been waiting for these answers for a while. And when she doesn't get the answer that she wants, when she sees herself in the reflection, it reminds me of Luke seeing himself in the Darth Vader mask, where it's like, this, whatever the answer is, it's not actually going to change who you are as a person. That's on you to figure out, which is, I think, another big part of Rey's character is her accepting and accepting her identity and making her own way, making her own name for herself. So that's kind of what I took away from that, is her kind of not confirming to herself, because I think deep down she knew that her parents weren't coming back. I think deep down she knew that they weren't, you know, in the grand scheme of things, significant. But she just needed something to confirm it to her.
Yeah.
For her to believe.
Yeah. It. My takeaway from that scene was, in certain literary elements, even biblical, the idea of something repeating itself is the idea that you need to commit this to memory. So the fact that she was asking the questions, like, and she was hoping the magic mirror was going to reveal the answer to the question, who are my parents? It was her. And that wasn't the answer that she wanted, but that's not the point. The point is, it's on you. That's how I took away from it. And so this repetition of herself in multiple versions doing the same thing and in tandem, the idea was, it doesn't matter who you're from, it doesn't matter who your parents were, it doesn't even matter what you want, like, it's up to you. You need to determine yourself. And I think that's what the Force was trying to tell her. What bothered me about that scene was, not bother me, but what I found interesting about it is it reminded me of, did you ever do this when you were a kid, when you go to the medicine cabinet and you have like the mirror in the bathroom and then you have like the medicine cabinet on the wall and you just sort of like open it up and all of a sudden there's like multiple versions of yourself and you're like, whoa. That's what that scene felt like to me. Like, I couldn't really take it seriously because all I can think about is me doing the thing with the medicine cabinet and like seeing all these parallel versions of myself. Like, I still do that today just for fun.
No, I get that.
Oh, you do it too? Yeah.
It was kind of funny.
Of course. Who doesn't?
It's definitely always like funny to see the first time. But I don't know how else. I'm not, you know, as smart as the filmmakers on how to show that. So I'm like, all right, if that's how they want to do it, I guess that's cool. I think a lot of the confusion came from people theorizing and speculating, you know, Rey, there's no way that Rey isn't like, she's not related to someone. She has to be. Maybe she's a Kenobi. Maybe she is Luke's long lost daughter. Maybe she's Ben's twin.
Which would have been weird, but also parallel to Luke and Leia. But I think that's sort of the point. Like it didn't matter. And I think that's something else I did appreciate about the movie is that it turns certain predispositions on its head in order to formulate something new and original. For instance, I noticed that there was an element of foreshadow when Rey and Ben are doing their little force time thing for the first time, and they're trying to figure out like, who is this? Wrong number. He foreshadows Luke's death. I think he says, "You're not doing this. The effort would kill you." And not just foreshadowing Luke's death, but his own in The Rise of Skywalker. Because he also does the force time thing when they're trans, you know, that took a great energy when he does his little shoulder shrug thing, which is a cool power move. But that did take energy to fight the Emperor at the end. So for him foreshadowing Luke's death at the very end, which is also Luke himself foreshadowed what was going to happen in the very beginning. Like, you think I'm going to stand with a laser sword in front of the first forced order? And that's exactly what we see at the end of the movie. Mm-hmm. So we should have known.
And I think when we see that actually happening, my first thought was, this is a little ridiculous. How is he going to take down all of these walkers and all of these other things on his own? Like, it does sound kind of ridiculous. Like, what did you expect to happen?
Not as ridiculous as the last of the resistance trying to run their little jalopies against like these giant King Kongs of walkers. But, you know, desperate times calls for desperate measures, you know?
Mm-hmm. And that ties into the theme of not fighting what we hate, but saving what we love. I think that's a big theme, very obviously at the end, because Rose literally says it. But that's the lesson that Poe has to learn. That's the lesson that Finn has to learn. I feel like that's kind of the lesson that Rey has to learn about herself, too.
And do you think, though, at the end, The Rise of Skywalker, at the very end of the movie, do you feel that she has what it takes to continue the journey on her own to, you know, sort of like find herself? Or do you think that she already found her place at the end of the movie?
I want to say I think she, more so than her finding her place, I think she is finally recognizing her place and recognizing her potential, that she is the future of this legendary thing now, the legend of the Skywalkers, the legend of the Jedi. I think she's finally accepting, like, I was the hero this time, or I am the hero this time. I have to be the hero. And that's why there's, you know, the whole debate about Rey Skywalker, whatever you want to say about it. The takeaway that I get from it is that she recognizes the impact that the name Skywalker has. And she wants to respect the name by carrying it on, because there aren't any Skywalkers left.
Yeah, I've talked about that before. And that's something that I have to have a firm stance on in that adopting the name is valid, especially if you know, you know, what your background is. But the idea at the, at least at maybe not so much her journey in the first two movies, but definitely at the conclusion, she represented, well, she represented orphans in The Force Awakens, and then she represented the story of immigrants in The Rise of Skywalker. And I can relate, you know, this experience is, that hits close to home because my parents are immigrants. My great-grandparents are immigrants. And historically speaking, for as, I mean, in even in ancient manuscripts, the idea of a person being of a lineage or of an unknown lineage, adopting the name of someone else and then carrying on that name, that's been happening in recorded history forever. So what she's doing is not that different. She saw the Skywalkers as her family. She could adopt the name of Palpatine, but it's no different than someone saying, you know what? I'm going to keep the name Hitler, but I'm going to just keep doing good things. No one is going to take you seriously for that. No one is. That's why no one has done that. So for her to, you know, she had no name when she grew up. She didn't know she had a name. And then for her to see Luke, Han, and Leia, like the Skywalker sort of crew, as her family, it was logical that she adopted that name. And now she'll carry on that name, hence the Rise of Skywalker. So in terms of that aspect, I wholeheartedly agree with. There was a couple of details that I noticed in the movie, and I want to get your opinion on. There was a Kyber crystal, you know, in the beginning, where it's specifically red Kyber crystal. Whose was that? Was it Vader's?
It was not Vader's. I remember I've looked this up before. I can't exactly remember who it belonged to. I don't know if it was actually confirmed, like in the novelization. I haven't gotten through the whole thing. The red crystal on Luke Skywalker's necklace is indeed a Kyber crystal. It's not his father's, though it did once belong to a Sith Lord. So I think it ties into something from maybe Legends that was kind of brought in as a little Easter egg, which I think is cool that they're actively trying to bring in some elements of Legends lore into canon. I think that's pretty cool that they're trying to do that.
I'm a little disappointed if it's not actually Vader's. You know, it's something that's reminiscent of, I mean, having a red Kyber crystal as a Jedi Knight or former Jedi Knight in his mind, sort of a reminder of, don't do this. Don't just, whatever you do, don't go down this path. And if it was his father's lightsaber, it will also act as a reminder that there's hope, that the hope that you had toward Vader, that you saw the good in him, and now Miss Nobody is knocking on your door saying, hey, we need your help because your nephew still has some good in him. Why didn't that like click immediately? But it did at the end, and he did what he had to do in order to teach one final lesson to Kylo Ren in on Krait. The other thing that I noticed, so we haven't talked about Vice Admiral Holdo, and she gets a lot of flack. She, for instance, in the very beginning when Leia's indisposed and she's announced as the next in the chain of command, there's literally like even Poe's like, really, her, like, from this battle, like, she doesn't look like anything. So already the relationship is off on a bad foot, because she demeans him, or it seems like she's demeaning him, but then again, she also calls out, oh, by the way, didn't you get a bunch of people die, you know, didn't a bunch of people die under your watch just like a few minutes ago? And that's the reason why you're demoted. He's like, I've dealt with you hotheads before in the past. So correct me if I'm wrong, but she was not received well, at least on the initial release. Maybe to this day, she's not received well.
I would agree. I would agree with that. And even my first watch there, she was not my favorite character, especially coming off of The Force Awakens, and you're like, well, Poe's so cool. He's kind of like a little bit of, got a little bit of Han in him, a little bit of, he wants to be the hero. So it was kind of jarring to see someone kind of like knock him down a few pegs, especially because of what we saw. But for Holdo, she didn't see any of that. She, maybe she's heard of things that he's done for the Resistance, but she also just heard what he royally screwed
up. Real.
Disobeying Leia's orders, not respecting her, doing what he thought was right, which is not always a bad thing, because not your superiors are not always right.
Mm-hmm. Or they're not always going to be nice.
Yeah. And I know that there is a Leia novel that she goes into her relationship with Holdo. They like grew up together on Alderaan. So having that information, Leia really trusts her. And I feel like we should trust Leia from what we've seen of her. But I will say, like, when we first watched it, I was like, this is kind of dumb.
Yeah.
Like, she's not my favorite character. And I remember walking out of the movie theater and talking to my friends about it. And I remember them saying, like, well, why couldn't she have just told Poe her plan of what was going to happen?
Yeah, why couldn't she have? Actually, that's something that's bothered me for a while. Like, why didn't she?
The more I watch it, and the more I kind of see the relationship and see where they both fit into the Resistance, why would she tell him? She owes him nothing. She doesn't owe him. She's not obligated to tell him what her plan is, because as far as she's concerned, he is of lower rank than her. She is only going to give the information that she thinks is necessary. So to me, I understand after rewatching it a few times, kind of understanding her perspective about it a little bit. I kind of noticed a little bit of a real world parallel when she was being introduced. Poe was kind of like, oh, this is Holdo.
Yeah.
Kind of implying that, like, oh, a woman did this. And it does parallel real life things that women have to go through in leadership positions. So I know people are like, oh, The Last Jedi pushes a feminist agenda. And that's really the only thing that I see that is kind of a parallel to what women deal with in the real world. So I kind of like that they tied that little bit of real world stuff into it. Upon rewatching it, I kind of was like, oh, that makes sense that this interaction happened the way it did.
Yeah, Mike has his note where he goes, how does Poe not know who she is when there's only like 400 people left in the Resistance, especially like in your own your own chain of command? Like, how do you not really know who she is? I will agree with that. And that's something that my wife has experienced. That's something that many women in my life have experienced. That it's just, try as you might, you're never going to be looked at as a person of authority or command certain respect just because of the fact that you're a woman. I really don't want to assume that that's what was going on in Poe's head, because he looked up to other people, a strong female roles like Leia. But what he says and what his reaction and the reaction of others, I will agree, is a modern parallel to what we see today. And even the way that she was written, like Leia was in her, like, a robe, you know, wasn't like a fancy, you know, imperial kind of robe, but she also was like, you know, I'm in command, but I gotta look nice doing it. And I think part of her character, the way that she was written, was she was very lithe. She's got this long, like, kind of dress on, her hair is made up, like, she doesn't look like she's a person in command. But that's not the point. The point is, she is like, everybody else is dead. This is all you got. This is the person that you got to deal with. And even though whatever your takeaway may be as to how, if you're a person who's in a managerial sort of or leadership position, how you treat people under you, like, this is, in my opinion, this is not the relationship you want to be looking at or you want to emulate. But like you said, like, it didn't matter. The story was, there's a plan. I don't owe you anything. You dumb messed up. How can I trust you that you won't royally mess up like you did
before.
Right. And I think that was a big part of Poe's arc in the movie, that he had to kind of learn that he doesn't have to be the hero all the time, because he, like, you can put your trust in other people. And that was kind of what a big theme was about, not fighting what we hate, but saving what we love. But to do that, we have to work together with the people that we love.
Yeah. And I think that he saw that with what we saw that when he was in command in The Rise of Skywalker. He thought, yeah, I can do this. Yeah, I got this. You know, I've been in the business, I've been in the game for a while. And then now that he's a general, and then now that they're on Exegol, he's like, oh, we're going to die. I'm sorry, guys. He calls them my friends. Like, I'm sorry, my friends. I feel like the sense of failure before the People's Armada shows up. So like that moment is when it really hit him. So he must have been thinking back to what Holdo must have been feeling before she, you know, turned off the autopilot. One other scene, or rather the arc that I want to talk about is Canto Bight. I need some clarification as to why that was necessary. There were certain conversations I think were important, that I wish were fleshed out a little bit more, like how, I forget the hacker's name, the one that was played by Benicio del Toro.
I think DJ.
DJ. Name. Okay. His stutter was actually kind of interesting. I think he said that he put that in because it would make the character more unique, because no one in Star Wars has ever had a stutter, which just kind of makes sense. Yeah. Just like it wasn't until The Mandalorian, no one in Star Wars wore glasses.
Mm-hmm.
But his, he said something really interesting on their way back, how, basically in war, only one side profits. It doesn't matter which side wins, somebody else is going to profit off of it, whether it be X-Wings or TIE Fighters. So in that aspect, I think it was important to say that message, but the arc with Canto Bight doesn't really make much sense to me. Could you give a little bit of clarification on what you thought about it?
Yeah, the more I watch it, the more I'm kind of okay with how it happened the way it did. I think you could kind of replace Canto Bight with any other insert mission that we think is going to help here. I think the point more was the failure aspect of it, and it was more of to push forward Finn's story arc and get him to, like, realize that this thing is bigger than himself. And instead of just focusing on, I have to save my friend, or I just want to do my own thing, by hanging out with Rose, he learns, okay, wow, this thing is bigger than I am, and I have a responsibility to it. So, I mean, Canto Bight is not my favorite part of the movie. The first time I watched it, I was like, this is kind of dragging on a little bit. I think it definitely could have been maybe edited differently or cut down a little bit. It was very kind of on the nose of this is war. There's, you know, like, the weapons dealers are selling to both sides. So what does it really matter?
Yeah.
What they're fighting for, because that both sides are going to lose at some point. Who's really benefiting from this? The people that are selling these weapons.
Yeah.
And the people are going to suffer no matter what, no matter who's in charge.
I think it's an interesting point to talk about, but it felt like a very side theme. Star Wars is, in its origins, a critique of the real world. And when it started, it was a critique of American imperialism on the global scale, especially during Vietnam at the time. That's not new. So to insert that arc in there as a story element, it is important, but you have then what I felt was like too many themes getting added on top of each other. Like that would have played great as a theme in something like Rebels, for instance,
where it's not contingent to one continuous storyline, but maybe a few short stories. And I don't know. I just felt like that overall didn't really add to it. Like, but like you said, it could have been a as long as it built the arc and the character growth of like Finn and Rose, that would have been great. But it just felt like a weird tangent to go off on. And if I'm not mistaken, they didn't even get the right guy, did they? DJ was not the guy that they were looking for.
No, it was supposed to be
the James Bond of Star Wars.
Justin Theroux played him. Okay. That was who they went to originally look for. And then they ended up with DJ. And I think DJ kind of acted as like the devil on Finn's shoulder. I think that was kind of more of the point. I think the emphasis was put a little bit too much on the arms and the war aspect. It kind of felt a little bit out of place. I won't disagree with that. But I think it was more to show Finn, he can listen to Rose, who is someone who has lost everything but still has hope in, you know, their what they want to accomplish in the resistance. And then you have DJ who's like, well, it doesn't matter anyway. So why do you care, or why should you care?
Yeah, he's definitely more dark side and Rose more light side to Finn.
Yeah, I think they could have done it a little better. I mean, they touch on it in The Mandalorian with Mayfield's character when he's talking to Mando, and they're kind of driving through this village, and they were like, doesn't matter who's in charge, it's all the same to them. They're going to suffer under whoever because they're just the little people and they're not going to be looked after like they should be.
I will continue to be of the belief that that episode was for Mayfeld, for a character like Mayfeld, was it told a much more powerful story of how this person was and then how this person is at the end of it and how they change in the Star Wars universe. I feel like that's such an important episode. We talked about it. So I've asked this question, not to deviate too much, but I've asked the question before. The title of the card of the episode was The Believer. And usually when they say in the definitive, the child, the sin, the Mandalorian, they're talking about something one specific. I think that was the one episode where it's like, you don't really know exactly who it is because there's two different believers. So who do you think it was that they were talking about? Was it Mayfeld or was it Mando?
That's a good question. I feel like you could argue it could be anyone because they all, you know, believe in something different. I think maybe it was a little bit of both because Mayfield was someone who obviously, I guess, put his faith in the Empire because I don't know how much to the extent that he like cared about the cause while he was in it. But through his journey, he realized they don't actually care about you. So why would he believe in something like that? And maybe because of Mando grew up in this essentially cult where he was taught to believe one way was the way of life, being able to talk to other people who have these outside experiences, which I think was like a big part of his arc, realizing that there isn't just one way to live or what one thing to believe in. So maybe a little bit of both.
Yeah, I think so. I agree with that. You know, it's the title card was, I think, meant to be a trick question because both actually had to change. They had to turn their viewpoints on their head in order to, one, complete the mission, but two, just to survive the rest of their lives. They had to adapt and to change what they were so driven on. So I wanted to discuss, you know, what could go wrong. So we have a lot of lore in Star Wars now, but being fans, I think we do have the right to be a little, not to provide unjust criticism, but to be a little critical of the storyline of the universe that we enjoy. So I want to get your opinion. If, like, for instance, what could go wrong now that the story of, and I'll lump the two together, The Last Jedi and The Rise of Skywalker, now that time has passed, we see how they both connected. Now that the story elements of The Last Jedi and, the sequels in general have already taken place. How do you think that this is going to affect the rest of the Star Wars storyline or Star Wars history from here on out?
That's a great question. I really hope that they add more to the sequel time period, because very much like the Clone Wars helped the prequels, I think something like that would definitely help out the sequels and maybe how they're seen if we get more information. That is like the sequels is like the farthest in the timeline. That, if you want to say that's like the present, that is the farthest we've gotten. But we've seen with The Mandalorian, like slowly kind of tying into the sequels. I think there's a big story you can tell leading up to that. There's not a lot that we know between the period of the New Republic until the rise of the First Order. I think there's a big story that they can tell, whether it's what they're doing in The Mandalorian, talking about kind of strand casts and how Palpatine was able to rise back to power. But I would like to get more information about the politics of the era, because I think the sequels kind of lacked in that. Whereas the prequels gave us a lot of it, the sequels really didn't give us a lot. Some of the books touch on it a lot. I read Bloodline is going through Leia's story as a senator. It's about 5 or 6 years before the events of The Force Awakens. So that gives us a little bit of information of the state of the world, but I also recognize that not everyone is going to read the Star Wars books. So I'd love to see more of that in kind of more of the mainstream media. But yeah, I think there's a lot they could do after. I would love to see what happens with Rey trying to rebuild her Jedi Order, or something new that goes beyond what the Jedi were supposed, like goes beyond the Jedi, because clearly the last two trilogies have told us maybe this isn't the right way to go about it. I'd love to see her train Finn, like we saw in the Lego special. That would be lovely.
Yeah, I think the Lego special is the best we're going to get, at least for a very long time.
Yeah.
I know that the original, the main cast, well, first of all, there's two things. Anything they move forward has to be completely from scratch, which would be fresh. It would be great because we get to see something completely brand new, kind of like what we were seeing in this new sequel. But we also have to remember the original characters have now died. They're now died off. We no longer have Han, Luke, or Leia. And Lando's still around, but we don't know for how long we have him. Same thing with Chewie. So we don't know how long the original characters we have, and now that these new characters, they have so much potential. But unfortunately, the actual actors have been vocal about, yeah, I don't want to touch this ever, or at least for a very, very long time, especially John Boyega. He's expressed, if I understood correctly, he's expressed concerns like, I really don't want to touch this. But then again, I think Chris Evans also said something as much. And then you can, if you cut a big enough check, you're like, yeah, let's do this. I'll be Captain America for 20 more movies.
Right.
So at this point, we don't know what's going to happen. But there's a lot of potential for graphic novels, for novelizations, for Lego movies, mm-hmm. which I would not mind if the future characterizations were in Lego format. The future is pretty ripe, but what I have noticed is that they're focusing on the past again. Now the big focus is the High Republic. So now they're sort of, I don't want to say backtracking, but they're sort of going back in time and telling brand new stories of a time period also that we had no idea of.
I think so. I mean, with all of this stuff, I've been reading some the High Republic stuff, and it's really awesome. It shows us what we wanted from the Jedi in the prequels, but didn't get what the Jedi were supposed to be is, so far we've seen that's like the closest that we've seen to that. I think that all of the new content we've been getting, a lot of the things have shown us how great Star Wars can be, like without the main OG cast, because we've got Rogue One, we've got The Mandalorian, even Star Wars Rebels, you've got the cameos from those characters, but I would argue in most of those things, taking those cameos out does not detract from the full story and the story that they were trying to tell. So even though we're kind of backtracking with the High Republic, it's still new to us. We're not you know, Yoda's the only one that's around during that time period.
And even then, my understanding is that he's a different character. He's a different person.
Yeah.
He's a little, I don't know, wilder, I guess. He's not as mature as the Yoda, Grandmaster Yoda, that we're used to seeing in the movies.
Yeah, I think he's still kind of viewed that way because he's been around for so long. And we haven't seen a lot, at least in the novels. We've seen him kind of training the younglings and the Padawans in the comics. So I'm interested to see where they go with that. But yeah, he is essentially a different character.
Yeah. So I want to conclude on the parts that you liked the most about The Last Jedi. Like, what is a scene or the scenes that you enjoyed the most as your takeaway?
Let's see. I really connect with both Rey and Ben's character. So all of their scenes together, I think, and Daisy and Adam are just so great. I think they added so much to those characters that if it was someone else, I don't know if I would like them as much. Just the little things, the little facial expressions they both have. I love the cinematography. I don't think anyone will argue that it's not one of the most beautiful Star Wars films that we have.
That red throne scene was really cool.
It's so cool. I love, and beyond just the expansive cinematography, I love the emphasis they put on like the faces and the hands of people. It seems like a very intimate moment between these characters that I feel like we're intruding in on something super personal. Even in the beginning, when we see what happens with Paige, that shot of her while the bombs are going off is so intimate, as we're seeing like her last moments of life, I think is really powerful. The camera almost lingers on the characters' faces almost too long, to the point where we see more than we usually get, I guess, if that makes sense. And I think the performances of all the actors really add to it too.
Yeah, when it hangs on a moment, if it's done well, it's an important moment, and it makes us. It's meant for us to feel a certain way when they do that, and I found that was interesting. Hands is also something that, like, Luke and his robo hand is not too different than what we used to see, especially at the very end of, when Luke's hand gets cut off and we see him with his robo hand first time, and at some point Darth Vader's also pensive, he's looking at his own hands too. Like, this is a parallel to my experience back when I fought Obi-Wan. So it's definitely a callback to those things. Some of my favorite moments in the sequels in general, it had a special form of humor. Like, before we used to have Han as the comedic element, I guess. He was very sarcastic. This time is Poe. And Poe is probably my more favorite characters. And what I really loved about The Force Awakens is, like, it opens up with here's the bad guy, the person he's been fighting. He's face to face with him and goes, "So who goes first? You talk or I talk? Do I talk first? Do you talk first?" You know, so he does that.
Yeah.
The fact that this movie opens up with him prank calling literally the entire First Order and goes, "Hey, General Hugs, is your refrigerator running?" Yeah, that really set it for me. Is like, yeah, I like this.
Yeah, and I know there's some people that have complained about the comedy in The Last Jedi that it might be too much, and I like it a lot. I think it is a good kind of shift for the darker tone that the movie takes on. Yeah. And also, I rewatched the prequels not too long ago, and the whole, like, first 20 minutes of Revenge of the Sith is just straight up comedic relief. I'm like, have you watched that movie? Like, that is corny as hell. So I don't know what you're like. The Star Wars has always been this. It's very campy, and that's what part of the charm of Star Wars.
Yeah.
So it doesn't bother me, and I think seeing Rian Johnson's other films, it definitely has a little bit of his own personality kind of shines through the writing. Especially with those comedic moments, which I appreciate, because we don't always get that from filmmakers.
Yeah, like
I saw the one. I saw two other moments that I liked. The Kentucky Fried Porgs. You know, when like Chewie's about to like bite into it, and the they literally made a puppet. There's literally a pork puppet that they made to look sad. He's like, "Why are you eating?
Yeah,
why are you eating my? Food?
Are you? Like, are you pro? Are you pro pork or anti pork? That's a very important question.
I think they would probably be great with barbecue sauce. You know,
probably.
Like those.
Yeah,
probably those secret spices. I don't know. I feel like it was interesting. Like, oh, we got this island. We got these real puffins. Instead of editing out, let's just make a new toy out of it.
Once I found the learned the background behind why the porgs were there, I was like, I'm sold. I love it. It's amazing.
Yeah. So if you're not aware of this, when they started filming those scenes in Okto, it's a real island. I want to say in Greenland. I don't remember where exactly. But there were actual puffins on location. So instead of editing the puffins out, they, from a distance, you can see them, you know, fly because they jump off the cliffs and they fly short distances, whatever. They rewrote a new creature into the Star Wars, and that's why we have porgs. So close up, they look different, but from a distance, they're just puffins. And from a capitalistic move, it's genius because now you have a brand new toy that you can sell to kids and make Lego pieces out of, and it is a heel to Chewbacca and his tummy because you know, a big Wookiee has got to eat, you know. And the other moment I loved was R2, top three favorite droid hands down. He shows up to remind his BFF Luke, this is the battle, this is what we're up against, we can't let us down. And then Luke is like, I don't have what it takes. And then he pulls a super cheap move and he goes and plays the hologram of Leia, you know, reaching out to Obi-Wan, and Luke goes, that's a really cheap move. And then R2 looks at him and he gives him the side eye like,
come on, bro. Yeah.
That move was such a power move on R2's part.
Yeah. I think my favorite moment in the whole movie is Yoda and Luke. That's just peak Star Wars. It was emotional. It was funny. It served a purpose.
What was his line? He goes, page turners, they were not.
Yeah. It's like, it reminds me so much of their relationship in Empire. And I think people were, I remember there was a thing that Anakin was originally in the plan to maybe show up on Okto. But to me, it makes more sense that it would be Yoda, because Yoda was his teacher, and he's coming back, and he's like, I thought I taught you this lesson already, and now I'm coming back to try to teach you again.
Like, I literally have to come back as a Force ghost to tell you, bruh, really? Did you learn nothing?
Yeah, and I love the line, the we are what they grow beyond, because that's a big theme of the sequels, is we're passing the torch on to a new generation.
Yeah.
Because like it or not, the sequels are for this generation of kids, and that doesn't mean that you can't enjoy it at all. My favorite Star Wars memories is when I saw The Last Jedi in theaters. We got to the Holdo maneuver, and you know, the movie is silent. The whole theater was silent.
That was powerful.
One of the most beautiful shots in Star Wars, whether you like the Holdo maneuver or not, but it was completely silent in the theater. And this little kid from a couple rows up, everyone is quiet, and he just goes, whoa. And the whole like theater erupted in laughter after that. And that's really what Star Wars to me is about, is the magic of it.
That's a beautiful sentiment. That's exactly what it should be like. And to your point, for those of us who maybe grew up with the original trilogy, or even grew up with the prequels, we have to concede this movie is not, or the sequels are not for us. They're for us to enjoy, but they're really for the new generation of Star Wars fans. And we have to concede that to that point. So, Brooke, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
How is it that our audience can reach you or find you?
Sure. Most of my content that I post is on TikTok. I'm just B_Dazzler. Like I said, I do a lot of Star Wars stuff. Lots of funny things. I would call myself the resident simp for men with morally gray areas. It's fine. But I like to talk a lot about character development. I'm a very character driven person. So whenever I get to talk about that, especially with the sequels, I feel like those are the characters I understand the most. I do a lot of that stuff. And you can also find me on Etsy. I have an Etsy shop. I'll just quick plug. It's called Far, Far Away Factory. I do a lot of fandom stuff, mostly Star Wars, jewelry, clothing.
You make earrings out of actual Lego.
Yes,
right?
I do Lego earrings. Yep. I also do some custom work. I do custom painted jackets and shoes and all that fun stuff.
So something I've been disappointed in is that I actually haven't seen you bedazzled anything. Like for a name like Bedazzler, you have a gross shortage of bedazzled items. And I'm very disappointed in you.
I've been meaning to. My problem is I make stuff for other people and then I forget about myself. So maybe I'll bedazzle myself a jean jacket.
Oh, man. Really, we got to bring that back. Yeah, bring that back. VMAs all the way.
Oh, yeah.
Well, speaking of social media, we have been doing some rebrand in the past several months regarding our social media on the focus on the show. So please make sure to check us out on our Instagram. But we've also been doing a giveaway, and I'll announce it again on TikTok and Instagram, where we are giving a Lego mini version of the Assault Walkers from The Last Jedi. So you can find that on TikTok and on Instagram as to how you can snag yourself a version of that. But also make sure to check out our Pew Pew t-shirt that we have available in our Etsy store, as well as the other This Is The Way items in Arabesh on our shop. That's all for this episode. Thank you for joining us.
If you like this episode, please subscribe and share and write a review on Apple Podcasts. It's the easiest way for people to find out about our show, and it would mean a lot to us.
Also, please follow us on Instagram at Death Watch Podcast, on Twitter at Death Watchcast, and also on TikTok at Death Watchcast. If you have any comments, or we missed something, or you have a suggestion for a future episode, you can email us at deathwatchpodcast@gmail.com, and we'll be able to feature it on a future episode.
Thanks for listening. This is the way.
This is the way.
This is the way.